big hand, a big hand for Mike. Thank you.
One of his interactions from Tim, to which I wasn't privy beforehand, so he stole some of my lines. I'll try to work around that. My task really is to attack the half problem head on and to say that the whole thing is a mistake, that we shouldn't take it seriously. I'll try to do that to the best of my abilities. I must say Marianne's presence here is somewhat intimidating, because I will have to skip very lightly over details of a vastly complicated subject, and therefore inevitably some of the things I'm going to say are going to be perhaps too simplistic, if I may say so. Please bear with me. As I say, it is a vast subject. And when preparing for this talk, I naturally did the thing that one does, and that is to consult the staff of the Encyclopedia of Philosophy to see how it defines the problem itself, because they have been very to Tim's splendid explanation of how it all is all laid out. I went to Stanford, and Stanford has this to say. It says that the Hart problem, originated by Chalmers in 1995, is more or less that of giving an intelligible account that lets us see in an intuitively satisfying way how phenomenal, or what it's like, consciousness might arise from physical or neural processes in the brain. That seems about right. That covers most of the attempts to deal one way or another with the Hart problem I ever came across. But it also brings to me immediately two huge red flags. There are two immediate issues that I can see with this one. The first one is intelligible account in an intuitively satisfying way. Do tell me, please, which of our current physical theories is intelligible and intuitively satisfying? Quantum mechanics, maybe? If so, please, I mean, the Nobel Prize is waiting for you. General relativity, the clash between the two. I mean, even just the physiology of human brains, never mind about human minds, the physiology of vision is far from intelligible and intuitively satisfying. Why on earth do we expect minds to be intelligible and intuitively satisfying? I simply don't understand. It's an unattended demand. But secondly, there is this issue. The explanation is supposed to tell us how it arises from physical and neural processes. Now, physical processes, what is a physical process? I mean, what are we talking about? Are we talking about current physics? Well, it can't be, because we know that current physics is wrong. We know that for a fact, because our two main theories of physics clash with each other head on. They cannot be both right. This is a well-known problem, and usually also get around it, and Chalmers did in his book, The Conscious Mind, in 1996, by appealing to completed physics. Physics as it actually is, physics as we will eventually know it. But again, there's a huge problem with this. Because physicists are a pragmatic lot. They will accept whatever works. If, for example, panpsychism that Tim is going to advocate turns out to be right, well, then consciousness is a property of matter, and the whole problem, the whole issue changes completely. On the other hand, if you look back into history, Newton, for example, would find our current theories completely outrageous. Don't start me on the subject of quantum fields. I mean, quantum fields? I won't go there, but those of you who know a little bit about quantum mechanics will probably know what I mean. Newton would be just outraged by the whole idea. Why do we think that the completed physics is not going to offend our intuition in absolutely every way possible? The very fact that you have to bring in completed physics into the subject in the first place brings in a huge unknown, potentially unknowable factor into the actual statement of the problem. And yet we expect to solve the problem, which is not well defined. How are we supposed to do that? Anyway, the upshot of this introduction is that insofar as the heart problem is supposed to be an argument against physicalism, I can't defend physicalism because I have no idea what it is. What I can do instead, I can argue against the main arguments in favor of the heart problem. And Tim's introduction very handily mentioned that what I think are the two main ones. One is the phenomenal consciousness and qualia, as follows, and the other one is philosophical zombies. Let's discuss this qualia. What are qualia? A quick Google search brings in some definitions. Qualities are qualities of phenomenal experience. It's the what is like character of mental states, or the introspectively accessible specific something, making e.g. perception of red color what it is. Well, all of that is rather vague. I mean, these are not real definitions. They are very vague descriptions, hand-waving descriptions of something. It can be worse. I've also seen qualia defined as whatever it is that makes life worth living. Fine, all right. So what does Stanford have to say on the subject? Surprise. Stanford offers four distinct definitions. It's phenomenal character of experience, or it's properties of sense data, or it is intrinsic non-representational properties of whatever, or intrinsic non-physical inevitable properties. This is the one that Dennett usually does when he discusses qualia. There is a problem in the whole subject, and I dare say the other speakers will not thank me for this, but the trouble is that whenever complete amateurs or professional philosophers, when we speak on this subject, we don't know what we are talking about. Things like that. And the reason we don't know what we are talking about is because nobody can agree on basic terms. I'll then show you that we cannot agree what the physicalism means, and Charles is supposed to be attacking physicalism. Qualia, again, this is a central concept of the whole issue, and there's no argument what they are. Perhaps it doesn't matter so much, because there is lots of fine-grained argument about all these definitions, how they relate or don't relate to each other, etc. I think we can, in the first instance at least, ignore all of that, because the main point is supposed to be that qualia somehow make it impossible to analyze mind scientifically. They are inaccessible to science. Well, let's have a look at this one. Because there are no proper definitions of the terms in question, the whole debate is conducted in terms of thought experiments, of report stories, and of course them intuition pumps. And here's the main one of the main ones in favor of qualia. It's about Mary, the shockingly mystical scientist. Mary's story is fairly simple. Just what ethical board approved the experiment, I have no idea. Mary is brought up in an environment which is completely devoid of color. She can see in her environment nothing other than black and white and gray in between, obviously. But she also happens to be a genius. And when a genius does, she learns all there is to learn about perception of color, all the science and teachers on the subject. Absolutely everything. And then one day she is released from her confinement and she sees a rose. And she explains, oh, that's what it's like to see the red color. So, what's the point of the story? The point is that knowing all there is to know scientifically, Mary still learns something new on seeing a red rose. Therefore, physicalism, or rather, to be more precise, scientism, must be wrong. Science cannot touch this notion of what it is like to see the red color. What's wrong with this tale? Well, there are various objections. Firstly, one can object that the practicalities of eliminating color experience are rather considerable. And my immediate response when I first learned about this sort of experiment was to deny that it's possible at all. But on reflection, I have to admit that if, for example, Mary is born with the cones in her retinas completely dysfunctional, she will only see black and white, and maybe somebody invents a miracle cure, and suddenly she can see colors, no problem. So is this particular objection to be answered like this? There is one interesting wrinkle to this one. The question is, for example, can Mary dream in color? How do we stop her dreaming in color? And the answer is, apparently, since she never seen color, how can she dream in color? It's nonsense, it cannot be the case. But in researching this topic, I came across an interesting article in Scientific American in 2003, which mentions this strange case of matching colors. It talks about a colorblind patient who can see no colors at all, but who also happens to be synesthetic. And what happens, he sees some numbers, some digits, and some letters, the synesthetic is blue, in color. Well, for him, those colors don't exist, so he calls them Martian colors. They're impossible colors. This is a bit odd. Don't you think it is a bit odd? Because how does he know they are colors? Is it perhaps that the brain somehow, his brain manufactures the quality of color, generically saying this is color, this is not texture, this is not firmness, this is not sound, this is not soft, middle C or whatever. No, it's a color. He knows that. But it's an impossible color, which doesn't exist. So it would seem that our brains somehow can manage to manufacture qualia out of nothing. They do not have to be results of data, input of subjective experience or external world. They can be manufactured. Okay, it doesn't prove anything. You can argue that this still doesn't answer the main problem that Chalmers asks, namely, why is it what it is like? What it is like to see red? We'll come to that perhaps. The second objection is, and that's the one which was the second one that occurred to me when I first heard this particular tale, that what Mary learns is highly specific to her. That what she learns is the way her visual apparatus, her specific visual cortex, her specific experience conditions her to see the red color, which will be completely unique to her, because our brains are totally unique. The numbers are really astronomical. If you take a cubic millimeter of brain tissue, of human brain tissue, the number of possible ways it can be interconnected internally is greater by orders of magnitude than the number of atoms in the observable universe. So you take this complexity, you add to that the individual experiences which are layered on top of that, and, well, Mary must know everything there is about color. And we know from the previous bit, from the Martian colors, the brain can manufacture colors. Therefore, Mary should be able to know how to stimulate the brain in order to see colors. Therefore, she should be able to stimulate her own brain in order to see the red color. So, you know, if she really knows absolutely everything there is about color perception, there's something wrong with it. It doesn't somehow hang together. The answer to that, of course, is still obvious, because a qualifier, which is a person who likes qualities, qualifier will object, well, yeah, science can investigate the origins of qualia. That's not a problem. That is not an issue. The real problem is that what it's like experience. It is, why does red look like, well, why does it look like red? Well, my answer to that is, you know, how else can it look? It really reminds me of the tale told of Wittgenstein. A friend of his apparently once said, isn't it odd that it, no, sorry, Wittgenstein himself, you know, this odd that people thought for so long that it was Earth rotating, not the sun going around Earth. And a friend said, well, yeah, it's because it looks like the sun is going around the Earth rather than Earth rotating. Which Wittgenstein, after a little while, said, well, what would it have looked like if it had looked as though the Earth was rotating? And the answer is, because it would make no difference. It still looks exactly the same. So, if we take Darwinian evolution seriously, and I hope everybody in this lecture room does, if we take it seriously, we have to accept that evolutionary purposes of experience exist. In order to exist in our environment, we have to have an experience, because of some kind. We have to be able to react to the surrounding world. So experience is a given, it's a must. But that experience is not enough, it's got to be a differentiated experience. We must be able to tell green berries from blueberries, from red berries. So somehow there will be differentiation. Well, yes, but does qualify what? Why does redness present itself so vividly to me? Why is it such a life-giving, obvious, vibrant color? You know, this is the problem. It's not the origin. Forget about origins. It's the why of it. How of it? Well, this is a rapid hole of dualism, I'm afraid. Experiences do not present themselves to us. Because once you put it that way, you are already separated yourself as a subject from experience, which is being experienced. This is completely the wrong way of doing it. This is the way of Cartesian theatre, where homunculus sitting somewhere in the center of your brain experiencing. No. Redness is how we experience the red color. There is nothing more to it. Why do we expect anything? Yes, it's arbitrary insofar as it feels, how exactly it feels to you, because it's like overtones. If you take a musical instrument, different musical instruments, like an oboe and a piano, and both play the same tone, it's the same middle C or whatever, they sound different. Why do they sound different? It's because of the overtones. Because the central middle C excites other frequencies, and the same happens with our minds. We see a red color, and we know automatically that the red color is not like blue color. It's that the green is the most unlike red from other colors. We know that red is a warm color, the blue is cool. We don't need any theory of color to know that. We just know it. It is there. It is given to us. That, of course, blood is red. Therefore, red is danger. But red is also life. My mother used to wear a red dress, which I saw didn't suit her, so I didn't like red. So, you know, all of these together form a unique package, which altogether comprises your experience, which will be completely unique. There is absolutely no way a science can touch it, but not for any mysterious reasons, just because of its uniqueness. And yet, the question why still persists. All right, so we have to have these differentiated experiences. Why conscious? Why should we have conscious experience? You may be surprised to know that actually it's a good question. But unfortunately, the question is being asked in the wrong way. The question, the real question that I would say is, does intelligence require consciousness? It is not, why are we conscious? Evolution gave us consciousness for reasons already touched upon. Whether there are other ways of achieving the same aim, evolutionary aim, we really have no idea. So what is consciousness anyway? Philosophers differentiate between access consciousness and phenomenal consciousness. The difference is, very roughly speaking, that between what one knows and how one experiences. Personally, I don't think it's a very useful distinction, but fortunately we don't need to go there anyway. Another problem is the distinction which is merely a descriptive one. It does not actually say what consciousness is, it just does classification of two different kinds of consciousness. And access consciousness, by the way, is supposed to be fairly unproblematic, so people aren't too worried about it. The phenomenal consciousness is the real problem. When one asks what consciousness is, once again, there is no agreement on the subject. In a way, it's obvious. It's the state you are in when you are conscious. Well, that's pretty circular, isn't it? So that doesn't help either. So we come to the second great thought experiment, which underlies all of the problem issue, and that is philosophical zombies, which address straight, directly, the issue of consciousness. Strictly speaking, it's not zombies, it should be P zombies, or philosophical zombies, but for simplicity, I will drop the P in philosophical and just talk about zombies, and you will understand what I mean. As Tim already mentioned, zombies were introduced by Chalmers, and you have a bit of it in the handout, my part of the handout, where he explains in his philosophical twin, who is molecule for molecule identical to him in all aspects of demanded by physics, by completed physics, in all physical aspects they are absolutely identical. They are behaviorally indistinguishable, and yet his philosophical twin, a zombie twin, lacks completely phenomenal consciousness. As far as I'm concerned, this whole argument should have died long ago. But unfortunately, like a true zombie, it marches on and on. Still, we have to deal with it because it is a perennial one, it really is. So, as I said, zombies are just like human beings, in all physical and behavioral aspects, but like phenomenal consciousness. The argument goes like this. They are imaginable, therefore they are possible, therefore physicalism is wrong. Well, doesn't this question strike you as a little bit odd? I gave you a clue there in the red question mark. Since when? I do ask, since when does imaginability or conceivability, which for this purpose is just about the same thing, entail possibility? Interestingly enough, I have never come across any attempt to defend this general principle, and in readings through various stuff, unfortunately I can't remember where, either on Stanford or Wikipedia on the subject, it's been confirmed that indeed there is no general defense to all this particular proposition. What is there instead, and it's a very effective tactic, the people who defend this is a real problem, simply criticize any attempt to provide a counterexample. And if you think about it, to provide a counterexample is really quite hard. I wasn't able to come up with one. Every time I came up with one, I could shoot it down. So I started thinking about, why is it the case? Why is it so difficult? And once I put the question that way, the answer became obvious. It's because we routinely prune our notion of what is conceivable by our knowledge for what is impossible. For example, as a child, I may have thought that the cow jumping over a moon was perfectly conceivable. I mean, yeah, there's the moon, there's the cow, the moon is quite low at the height, and the cow might jump. As an adult, all adults in this room would not consider this as conceivable or imaginable, except in a very kind of fanciful way, which we don't take seriously. So, when we say something is imaginable, we don't mean that it's quite possibly, it's possible. What we mean is not known to be impossible, which is not the same thing at all. So that syllogism is a very dodgy one, but there are other problems. Consider that this particular reply is due to Marvin Minsky, AI guru, but it was brought up several times by other people. The premise is that it is possible to separate human experience, human physical aspects of a human being from consciousness, because you can imagine a zombie who is physically absolutely identical to a human being but lacks the consciousness. Therefore, it must be possible to separate them. That's the premise. And the conclusion is, guess what? That it's possible to separate them. The argument is completely circular. It assumes what it actually says is its conclusion. This was driven home by Brown, who later on produced a variant of the zombie argument by simply inverting it. Let us say that we have zombies who are identical in all non-physical aspects to humans, but have no phenomenal consciousness. They are imaginable, therefore, according to the standard argument, they are possible. But if they are possible, then it follows that physical aspects of a human being are sufficient for producing phenomenal consciousness. There is a complete, absolute formal symmetry between the two arguments, between the zombie argument and the inversion of it, and it arrives at a completely different conclusion. They're dancing because that such a priori arguments never lead anywhere. You cannot argue what is by simply juggling words, which is what this does. And for me, this should be enough to kill the whole thing stone dead. But there is more, there is more. How do I know you folks aren't zombies? After all, zombies are supposed to be completely indistinguishable from human beings in all aspects, in all behavior. Therefore, if I ask you, are you conscious? Johnson, are you conscious?
Yeah.
You are not. Fine, okay, you are not. But do you see what I mean? In order to be indistinguishable behaviorally from human beings, zombies would have to believe that they are conscious, because otherwise they would be lying. If they are lying, then surely they cannot just go through. Why would they be lying? You know, what's their motivation? They would have to have the same beliefs as we do. Okay, well, how do I know I'm not a zombie? Because if zombies believe that they are not zombies, then I believe I'm not a zombie, but maybe I am. Again, well-known problem, I'm not stating anything new here. Chalmers is well aware of the problem. Chalmers responds, zombies believe that they are not zombies, but their belief is false. I beg your pardon. Nature doesn't care about our true false labels. It cannot just be about semantics, surely. Is it about semantics? Really? What reason does Charles give for this remarkable statement? Well, you see, zombies lack the validating direct experience of phenomenal consciousness. This assertion of direct experience as true experience is an old problem in philosophy. What is direct experience? Answer, hand waving. Look, we have direct experience of vision. I can see you. I have direct experience of seeing. And yet the scientific elaboration, explanation, clarification of how it all happens, of things like saccadic movement of eyes, of the distinction between retina and nerves, all of it is completely unintuitive. We have no direct access to it at all. Why should we think that minds are any different? It's supposed to be obvious. What is the direct experience? Hand-waving is supposed to be obvious. It's as obvious as the sun going round the earth, I suppose, isn't it? Let's try a thought experiment of our own, shall we? Because, you know, thought experiments are good. Suppose I'm a zombie. Okay? I'm a zombie. I meet Chalmers' challenge head-on. Suppose Chalmers waves a magic wand to de-zombify me. Now, in case you don't think magic is imaginable, you can substitute sonic screwdriver or something like that. So, I'm now de-zombified. What has changed? Nothing. I'm still believing the same things I did. I still behave the same way I did. There's absolutely no detectable difference in what I am, how I behave. What has changed? Surely, nothing has changed other than the label true and false attached by Chalmers to my beliefs. Surely, a difference that makes no difference is no difference. So, in summary, the zombie argument conflates conceivable and possible, begs the question, appears to reduce to mere semantics, and assumes privilege of direct experience. The direct experience claim is the real issue here, I think. Consciousness as the agent, kind of something, chief executive officer in Trumpian mold, you know, advised and betrayed, but never constrained by a board of directors. It's such a seductive image. But Chalmers himself admits in that quote that Tim showed us that one possible solution to that problem is to say, well, maybe we misunderstood what consciousness is. Maybe we have to rethink what consciousness is. And I think that is correct. So if a direct experience claim is wrong, are there any alternative proposals? There are, actually. There are. And some of them will be mentioned later on by the other speakers. Unfortunately, my favorite one is not going to be mentioned, so I'll squeeze it in at the very end of the last 5 minutes of my talk. However, briefly, it's a big subject, it deserves more than that, but please bear with me, we haven't got the time. My favorite one is the global working space, which is badly misnamed, but I'll explain why in a moment. What it is. The global working space theories, which are originated by Bowers, developed by others, but in fact not all global working space theories are traceable back to Bowers, because Tennant now admits, finally, I have admitted, that his multiple draft theory of consciousness is also belongs to the draft of global working space theory. Alexander Oakley, whom I will mention later, claimed that they are not starting from bars, but in fact, I think they are squarely in the same mold. Anyway, the idea here is that consciousness should be thought of in terms of competition between non-conscious subsystems for a limited capacity, which broadcasts information for wide use and access. This goes back to the pandemonium model of early artificial intelligence. I think it was Oliver Selfridge who proposed it at the end of the 60s, 67. That was the first suggestion that mind can consist of a number of incorporating, as AI people call them, demons or subsystems. And that's really how we should think of mind. And in fact, most physicalist inclined philosophers these days accept this idea as a given. That's, you know, but that's where it originates. It originates in AI, in Selfridge's idea. Barras himself uses both space and broadcast analogies. And I think the space analogy is a highly misleading one, hence the global working space, because it brings to mind this notion of there is some place, being physical or virtual, in the brain or in the mind where it all happens. Well, that is not the idea at all. The idea really is that consciousness is about being somehow making available to all these non-conscious agencies, as Dennett calls them, information which needs to be shared. In this vision, consciousness is not a decision maker, but a subsystem enabling and possibly participating in flexible decision making by non-conscious agencies. I particularly like the extreme version of this, and Tim is wrong if he thinks the two last ones are the real extremes that we put in for Saturday, because I think this is the extreme one. Consciousness has no executive powers whatsoever. And having observed myself for quite a long time now, having first arrived at this conclusion myself about 10 years ago, I believe that is actually true. There is an obvious counter-argument to that, and that's presented very vividly by Jerry Fodor, who says, yeah, okay, fine, maybe mind is the number of these subsystems, etc., etc. If maybe it's a pandemonium, but if the pandemonium, somebody ought to be in charge, and by God, it's better than me. Well, I am in charge. How come? It's very simple. I am all of my mind. I am not just my consciousness. It is this identification of oneself with one consciousness that is a mistake. I am all of me, even my body. What's the problem? Well, the problems are manifold, of course. And when I was originally planning this talk, I was thinking that I perhaps could mention to you two very non-mysterious reasons why the heart problem is actually heart, but not heart is capital H. Unfortunately, we don't have the time, but you can always ask me in the coffee or Q&A or whatever, and I'll briefly summarize. Thank you for listening.
Mike, we now have some time for questions. Just to let you know that all the talks and the question time are being recorded, so your questions will also be on the recording, which will then go up on the web later on. Now, the way we do question time, for anybody who's unfamiliar with it, put up your hand and then I will notice that you are wanting to ask a question. And then when you see them nod, you can put your hand down. Okay. So, and Stuart has got a microphone back there, and he will bring them to each person here. So, first question we have from Bill.
Supposing it's not the motion, really, I think the Mary argument is also assumes its conclusion. In that it assumes that just by studying physics, you will not get the experience of redness. It assumes that, and then announces it as a conclusion. But my question is, you mentioned zombies, and the zombies can have beliefs, but they're false. Also. Surely if a zombie's got belief, it's not a zombie in the original sense.
Yeah.
All right, yeah. Fair point. I skipped that one. And I can do no better than to quote Dennett on the subject, who says, "No, absolutely true. That begs the question, to assume that zombies have beliefs. They have believed this is dead in the end. The question is, what's the difference?" You tell me.
They don't really have beliefs, they think they do.
Exactly.
Do we have any other questions for Mike? Yes, please, stand up there. You can just wait for the microphone to come around to you.
Mike, I thought you took a long time to get rid of the zombie argument because I really think it's a lot of rubbish, to be perfectly honest. I don't really think it deserves as much attention as it's given. You said some really very interesting and quite fundamental things about the definitions that you came across at the beginning. And I think they really are the root of the whole thing, is that you did say we don't know what we're talking about. Well, I think that we nearly always know what we're talking about, but we're talking about something different than what other people are talking about. and we can see that in society all the time. But despite that, there's a commonality, there's a degree of commonality amongst us all, otherwise we wouldn't be able to do anything. And I think the emphasis should be on trying to capture that commonality rather than just shrugging it off and saying, well, we can't agree. We have to get our arms around the commonality and develop that in some way or another. What do you think?
That's a fair point. The difficulty with that one is that we are in a position of trying to generalize from a single data point. We have only one example of intelligence, and that is ours. Well, I have no idea what the commonality should be. I don't even know what I put in common with you, to be honest. I know I can presume that I can communicate with you, that we have sufficient commonality to talk, but exactly what is invoked in your mind by me talking, I have no idea. There's a very good story, and I love science fiction, because science fiction knocks us out of our intellectual boxes quite often. There's a very good story by Ari Lafferty. I can't remember the title of it, unfortunately, in which somehow by technological magic two people are allowed to experience the world as each other, as the other one does. And that was horrified. One says, one is a man, a scientist, the other is written in a bad, more PC times, you know, one stereotypes to rule the world. One is a woman, which is very arty, very ongoing, extroverted, etc. And she experiences the world very sadly, and says, this is horrible. It's completely dead. It's devoid of color, it's devoid of meaning. I cannot exist in this world. And he responds with equal horror, saying, I cannot live in that world. It's so, all of it is so alive, it strangles me. You see, there is a story about Freeman Dyson and Richard Feynman. Feynman at one stage happened to mention that he couldn't both count the time, you know, tell time, period of time, while talking. That he couldn't really talk for 5 minutes and know that he was talking for. And Dyson said, oh, that's no problem. I said, so prove it. Right? Okay, give me a minute, you know, my watch, 1 minute. Okay, start now. Mary had a little, and blah, 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 minute. How the heck do that? I can't do that. It turned out what was happening. What the Dyson was imagining a clock on the wall, and he was just seeing a hand going tick, 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 tick while he was talking. Feynman was doing nothing of the sort. They were both doing the same thing, but doing them in completely different ways. And therefore this illusion, because we can communicate, it creates an illusion that perhaps there is more commonality than there actually is. We don't know.
Did anybody else have a question for Mike?
I stunned them.
Mike is there.
Hi. This is probably a bit naive, but
You did refer briefly to Jerry Fodor at your conclusion. I mean, he took the view that minds think about things, whereas when we, and so it's a very individual perspective on things, particularly the use of language. Whereas when one's dealing with scientific problems, one's dealing with a collective, and you use a completely different approach to language. To what extent is it possible that we've got two competing systems of communication that run parallel to one another without quite touching?
I agree entirely. In fact, you are touching on a favorite philosopher of mine, Davidson. In fact, it's mental events idea, and I know Marianne is also on board with this one. I agree with this conception entirely. There are two different descriptions of the same physical process. Obviously, I shouldn't say physical, that's purely stripping down the language whole. That there is a physical description of what's going on, and there is a mental description of what's going on. They are both describing the same goings on, the same process, but we have no reason to assume that they are intertranslatable. And Davidson shows very convincingly, to my mind, that it is possible that they need not be intertranslatable. In which case, when we are trying to ask the hard question, answer the hard question, what we are doing is impermissible, because we are mixing vocabularies of two distinct discourses which cannot be translated into each other.
So, on one of your last slides, you were arguing that there's no executive function amongst all of these different subsystems. I'm wondering how much of that is just a modern restatement of Hume from the treatise. I look inside myself, right? For me, the question is, every time that's stated, even in the context of this new modern terminology, there's always an I. And I'm wondering what that I is. You know, when I look inside myself, all I see is, you know, competing subsystems fighting for access to the global working space. Who is this I? What is this I?
It is an idea of the whole of me, of the whole of me. If you want a succinct answer. That is a key question indeed. And yes, I would argue, and I know that a number of philosophers would argue, that I, in that sense in which you describe it, in which Jerry Fodor described it, as, you know, that better be me in charge, is an illusion. It does not make consciousness an illusion, but the I itself is a misconceived illusion. Yes, I would say so.
We have time for one more question.
Ooh, yeah.
No, don't worry. Firstly, let me say where I'm agreeing with you. I actually agree that the hard problem is not that hard. So I agree with your main theme. Oh, sorry. Sorry, I've got such a loud voice. Presumably you're already hearing me, but here I am. So I'm just saying I agree with the idea that the hard problem isn't as hard as some of the thoughts did. I also agree very much with the two things that you said at the beginning, and the idea that we should make something intelligible and intuitively satisfying, when physics is very far from either. I think it's very important to recognise that. And really, the question I want to ask is a question of clarification. I didn't quite understand what your objections were to the Mary Thought experiment. I mean, I actually don't particularly like the Mary Thought experiment, but you seem to give three. Firstly, does Mary dream in colour?
Yeah.
To which the answer is presumably no.
No, the answer is we cannot prevent her dreaming in colour because the colour structures are presumably built into the brain, as we know from the space of strange Martian colours.
I didn't understand the strange Martian colours. I mean, perhaps you might. The other thing is the second one was the specificity of Mary's experience. And I didn't understand that as an objection because
Yes, of course, her experience is unique to her, just as yours is unique to you. But the thing about language is that it enables us to find enough commonality to communicate.
But the language, language does not give you how it feels.
No, it certainly
doesn't. Therefore, the language is irrelevant in this respect. The uniqueness of her experience matters because, yes, she does learn something new, simply because her actual experience is going to be unique, and she doesn't have the knowledge of herself. I mean, do you know, can you in principle, however, you know, however advanced science may be, can you in principle know the exact map of your brain cell by cell as it was 5 minutes ago? It's just not possible.
No, I'm not particularly keen on that area, but I can't see why the specificity of Mary's experience is a problem.
Okay, fair enough. By the way, I should have mentioned one thing, and thank you for reminding me. You probably know that Jackson, who invented Mary, actually no longer agrees with the intended conclusion of the argument. He himself now has been converted to functionalism. So, maybe you are right. My immediate response is that she learns something new because she learns something about herself rather than about the television and scientific meaning of the stuff. We are really back here to Davidson, and that is the fact that the language always operates in types rather than tokens. And Mary is a token, and as such, the language of science cannot tell anything about the token because it only talks in types, roughly speaking.
So she learns something about herself,
That's correct, yes.
Not something about colour.
That's correct, yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So can we say a very big thank you.